All right. Well, thank you, Jim. And thank you all for coming out this beautiful fall morning. I know you have other places you could be, and appreciate you coming to hear my talk. I'm going to be talking today about one of my favorite creation science topics, namely fossils and the fossil record. And I have a lot to cover, so I know you don't want to be here till sundown, so I'm going to jump right into it. But I'm going to begin with sort of a quiz. I'm going to quiz you on fossils. Usually in a crowd, everybody knows something about fossils, or quite a bit. And so I'm going to go ahead and quiz you on some fossils and just have some audience participation here. Go ahead and try to identify these for me. What are these?
Shark's teeth.
Shark's teeth. Okay, two shark's teeth, commonly found down in Florida. Okay, can you see that one?
Trilobite,
very good. I actually have that trilobite. It's about 2 inches long, but they can be quite large. Here's a picture of one about the size of a dinner plate. And they're extinct marine arthropods that apparently were alive at one time in great numbers. Okay, when I'm talking about old fossils, I have to be real careful about what I say on this slide, because that's my wife on the right, and on the left is the fossil I want to draw your attention to. She's there for scale. What's the skull, dinosaur skull? What kind of dinosaur is that?
Triceratops.
Okay, very good. Okay, can you see this one? I found this recently. I think this one's very interesting. What's it look like?
Bird, like a fish.
Yeah, or maybe just a dinosaur. I don't know if it's a bird or not. But it's a fish and a dinosaur overlapping, buried together, and fossilized. Those two don't normally live together, do they? wonder how that could have happened. Okay, anybody know the name of this fossil?
Archaeopteryx.
Very good, Archaeopteryx. This is probably the most famous fossil of all time. I've heard scientists say that this is probably the greatest natural history discovery ever made. And I'm going to be talking about Archaeopteryx a lot more in a few minutes. Okay, how about this one? Can you make out what that is? I think it looks like petrified roast beef, but corned beef. It's actually petrified wood, and that's a sample specimen I have. It's quite pretty. Here's a picture I took in California of petrified redwood. I mean, these trunks laying on the ground are like 5 feet in diameter. They're old redwood trees that have fossilized. Just amazing. Okay, these aren't really great fossils, but these are the first ones I found as a kid. I think I was in second grade when I found these up in Indiana. Anybody know what these are? They're sea lilies, crinoids, there may be some coral there at the bottom right. So they're not real pretty specimens, but they're kind of special to me because I found them many years ago. Okay, I want to ask you what this one is. It's hard to identify. They say it's a turtle shell, fossilized turtle shell. Okay, who can identify this one? That's obviously a dinosaur track. That's my hand right there. This hand, and I took that picture out in Moab, Utah, of a theropod dinosaur track. Okay, anybody dare say what they think this is?
That looks like
coprolite. Coprolite. Wow, this guy knows all the terminology. Excellent. And a coprolite is a fossilized animal dropping, and these are found in great numbers. I have one I bought off eBay. Just a little guy. And so they're fairly common, and people collect them. In fact, there was one just a year or two ago that is 40 inches long and was sold in auction for $8,500. So it's each their own, I guess. Okay, here's a fossil, a picture I took at the Dinosaur National Monument. And it's of a dinosaur, obviously. It's articulated, meaning all the bones are still in place. At least most of it's still there. But notice its neck and its head are back, are extended back severely. I'm going to be saying more about that pose in a minute. Okay, this is a fossil. I took a picture in a museum of fossilized ripple marks, like at the bottom of a pond or something like that. They would call these ephemeral traces, but they've fossilized before the ripple marks in the sand had gone away. After I used this picture because I liked the ripple marks, then I noticed, wow, that looks like a human footprint there. But I don't know that it is. Okay, everybody knows what this is. Anybody? Go ahead.
Fossilized
Eden. Amber. Yeah, it's amber, considered a fossil with a bug inside it. And there was a movie that was made famous, that made this kind of thing famous, Jurassic Park, if you remember that movie. And so these are important fossils. And this one, probably some of you have seen. Anybody? Well, first, it's a fossil of what? It's a T-Rex. Okay, Tyrannosaurus Rex. Anybody seen this specimen? Know where it is?
Sue.
At the zoo?
No, her name is Sue.
Sue, yeah, you know the name. And it's found in?
South Dakota?
Chicago. Oh, I meant it's displayed in Chicago in the Field Museum there, but I think it was found in South Dakota or North Dakota. So, yeah, very famous specimen of a T-Rex. They named it Sue, I think, after the discoverer. Then years later, they found it wasn't female. They figured out the dinosaur probably was male.
There's a song about that.
Yeah, Johnny Cash. I think it comes from that story. Okay, here's just another example of a fossil of a leaf, and the layers were cracked so that the fossil was opened up, and you can see both sides of where the leaf was. And they actually call this, using coin collecting terminology, the reverse and obverse of this specimen. Okay, what's this look like?
It's like eggs.
Yeah, they are eggs. These are dinosaur eggs. They're in a nest, and they're all gathered together. They seem to be in pairs, and that's common for this kind of dinosaur to lay two eggs at a time, lined up like that. Okay, this is a picture I took at the British Museum. It's an ichthyosaur, an extinct ocean reptile. And then, of course, talking about fossils, everybody wants to talk about caveman or hominids or early man, the evolution of man. And there's a couple skulls right there. But the evolution of man, the alleged evolution of man, would be a subject of another talk. But I'll just show this specimen. What you might know what this particular a hominid specimen is. It's called Australopithecus afarensis. They gave it the nickname Lucy, and it's probably one of the most famous fossils there is in the so-called study of the evolution of man. That's an interesting subject in its own right. This is a great fossil. This is probably, some of you have been to the Creation Museum up in Cincinnati. I'm sure the pastor has. He lives near there. Anybody else? Oh, more of you need to go. Fantastic museum. I mean, it's world class. It's not some rinky-dink, side-of-the-road museum. It is really good. And they have one of the best allosaur fossils in the world. It's very valuable. And they've named it Ebenezer. And so they have it here on display. Just a fantastic fossil on display there, owned by the Creation Museum. So really recommend you go in there. Okay, so that was a long pictorial introduction to the subject. let's dive into fossils a little bit. And I like to begin with definitions. So we're using the same terminology, or at least you understand what I mean by a word. So a fossil, the definition, is the remains or trace of a once living thing preserved by natural processes. Okay, that seems to make sense. And then I'll use the term fossil record a lot. And these are all the fossils that have ever formed, okay, whether they've been discovered, dug up at the museum, or if they're still out there, covered up, you know, remaining to be discovered perhaps someday. So the fossil record is everything that has fossilized. And normally we're talking about what's in the museum, but really we should refer to what's out there. Okay, well, why is somebody here talking to you about, you know, these old dirty rocks? Okay, should we be studying the Bible and learning how to witness to people? And I think that's what we're doing here. We're learning how to witness to people more effectively. And that's because there is, as you well know, this church is very well taught. There's a huge clash of worldviews between the Christian worldview and the atheistic or secular worldview. You know, I'm a Bible-believing Christian. I look at the world through a lens of the Holy Bible, the infallible Word of God, and I start with that. And then as I look at the world around me and evidence from the world around me, I see how it can line up with what I see in the Bible. And as others have said before me, is that what we see in God's world agrees with what we read in God's Word. Okay. On the other hand, the atheists, the evolutionists, the secular point of view, not believing in God, not believing in supernatural forces whatsoever, has to look at the world around us, the universe, and say, well, it looks like it must have formed over millions of years, and evolution must have been an effect to explain it. So we have these two warring views, and you all know, well know that this is a huge battle going on, and frankly, we're the minority. But, you know, I think the truth is on our side, and we need to use evidence from fossils, from science, to help us be a witness, a good witness for Christ. And this quote by Carl Sagan. Remember Carl Sagan? He's dead now. I guess you might say he's a creationist now, but it's too late for him. But he was famous. He's a famous cosmologist. He did the Cosmos series, talking about evolution of the universe. And he came out. He had this quote. He said, evolution is a fact amply demonstrated by the fossil record and by contemporary molecular biology. Okay, first of all, he says evolution is a fact. He calls it a fact. Well, that is patently false. And I say it's not demonstrated by the fossil record. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. Next time, if you'll have me back, I want to talk about molecular biology because it's the fossil record and molecular biology that are the best evidence for creation. It's amazing. And he's looking at exactly opposite to me. I can't see how he can say that, except he's clinging to his worldview. It reminds you of Romans 1, Romans 1:19 and forward, how they're willingly ignorant of the world around them. Of the truth of the Creator. Okay, how are fossils formed? We need to go into this a little bit. Probably most of you, if you're like me, you had an aquarium at one time, or at least you've been to the beach and you've seen a dead fish or something in the water. And what happens, say, in your aquarium with that dead fish? Does it settles to the bottom of your aquarium and over years it turns into a fossil at the bottom of your aquarium? No. What they usually do, they may fall to the bottom for a while, but then they float, and then the other fish think they're good-looking to eat. And most fish that I had that died, I never found again. You know, the other fish ate them up, and they just completely disintegrated and decomposed. That's how most things, when they die in water, that's what happens to them. They completely disintegrate, and there's no trace of them anymore. In order to form a fossil, you have to have rapid burial. Okay, we got a little cartoon here, and it shows this fish swimming along, and it's inundated by sudden deluge of salt, of sand, or sediment, And so it's smothered, it's killed, it's sent to the bottom, and under the right conditions, it could be covered up with quite a bit of sediment. In fact, it could be, you know, a great weight of sediment. And under the right conditions of us, you know, covering like that, the sand, the silt will turn to stone. It'll lithify, and in trapping the dead fish, in this case, in the layer. Okay, so that all happened before scavengers could eat the fish. It could just totally be disintegrated by bacteria, and so it's left there entombed in the sand or the silt. And then over time, those materials will turn to rock, will lithify. And so then over a longer period of time, the creature will decompose, leaving either a cavity or just an impression there, and minerals will seep into it and mineralize the open space and switch out the biological material with the stone, with crystals or some sort of mineral. In Colorado, they said they used to hunt for dinosaur fossils with a Geiger counter because the uranium in the ground, in the groundwater, would precipitate uranium in the fossil and form a fossil out of uranium-rich materials. They could find fossils with a Geiger counter. So anyhow, in order to have fossils formed, you really need rapid burial. That's an important point. Okay. I was looking at my next slide, so I'm sorry I had the wrong slide showing there. So there we have our fish fossilized at the bottom. Okay. This is a great fossil. This one is at the Creation Museum, and it's a horseshoe crab, which is buried alive. This one, I think, a really intriguing fossil. And horseshoe crabs are still alive now. They're called living fossils. And I don't know if you can tell from back there, but there's actually little tracks here, little footprints of the crab as it's walking along the sand. Pastor, do you remember this this up in the Creation Museum?
Yeah.
I think this is a really neat fossil. This proves that this animal was alive when it was buried. In fact, it even gets better than that because this is the entire fossil that they've mounted on the wall. The horseshoe crab. Is my cursor showing up over there?
Yeah.
Okay. The horseshoe crab is right there, and the tracks were found to extend all the way back here, like 15 feet of tracks, before finally this horseshoe crab just gave out in exhaustion, was smothered by the sand, and became a fossil eventually. Just an amazing fossil find. And it really proves, I mean, it's rock-solid evidence that that it was killed by being covered by sand. Here's another picture of it showing rapid burial. And this is an ichthyosaur. It's a marine reptile. These gave life birth. And this one, this ichthyosaur, was giving birth when it was killed and covered by sand. So even in the process of giving birth, it was smothered eventually turned into a fossil. And then here is a fish eating another fish. Before it could even finish swallowing the little fish, the big fish was killed and buried and turned into a fossil. Now, this is a fantastic fossil. Sometimes I wonder if this is a Chinese fake, because the Chinese have been faking a lot of fossils. And there have been big scandals in paleontology with fake Chinese fossils. You know, it's true with gold coins too, I guess. But even with fossils, there's money to be made in finding interesting fossils. And I don't know if you can make out what this is. It appears to be a Protoceratops fighting with a Velociraptor. The Protoceratops is sort of that toad-looking dinosaur. Now, there's a reconstruction of the model. This is a model of the fossil, to show the arrangement of the two dinosaurs. It looks like they're locked in mortal combat and have died, been covered, and fossilized. So I'm not 100% sure this is real. When I searched for it again last night, I was seeing positive hits that this is a real specimen, really amazing thing. Okay, now here's a picture of a very common pose for dinosaurs that we find in fossils, with its head extended back, and this pose is called Episthentonus, or this is the Episthentonic position. And it's very common in fossils. There's Archaeopteryx. It had the head stretched back in the same way. And then look at this one with the head stretched back, even the tail moved forward. And this is a very common position of death. It's just prior to death, due to asphyxiation, that the creature, and this is known with animals, you know, these days, that if they're dying of asphyxiation by drowning, perhaps volcanic gases, poisonous volcanic gases might have caused some of these, for them to take on that pose. And it's actually a muscle spasm. It's involuntary condition right before death. And many, many dinosaurs have found this way. And the evolutionists have puzzled over this for years and of course noticed it. And just recently there was a scholarly article that came out talking about the watery secret of the dinosaur death. And this is a popular press news article about the journal article, but these scientists had studied the death of animals and found out what kind of conditions caused this epistophonic pose. And it was due to drowning, asphyxiation, conditions that you would have expected to occur in flood, in a flooding condition. Okay, here's a picture of fossils of soft-bodied animals. And this is, again, very good evidence for rapid burial of the creature. Soft-bodied animals are easily broken down. They don't have bones that preserve, that survive longer. And so you would expect soft-bodied animals to be harder to find in the fossil record, but yet they are found. Here's an octopus. There's a drawing of the octopus right next to, here's the fossil, and there's a drawing of it. And they have it all labeled. The scientists can really determine a lot about the octopus from this fossil. And there's these others that are jellyfish fossils and an extinct Dickinsonia fossils. So this is more evidence that of rapid burial, flood-type conditions. And this point is pertinent to a later discussion of the Cambrian explosion. I like this one. This is the subject of polystrate fossils. Poly meaning many, strate meaning layers. And these are fossils that span many different layers of sediment. Now, if you were to plant a tree and you were to bury the tree, you know, 10 feet up the trunk, what would happen to the tree? It would die. I mean, they just don't survive like that. Yet here are fossils of trees that span 10, 20, 30 feet of layers. Okay, those trees weren't growing there while the sediment laid down over millions of years around the trees. That's impossible. They would have rotted out early on, fallen down, and you would have had no such fossil as these. And so these are excellent examples that the tree was alive and standing in place, and then there was an event, a flooding event, that deposited sediment around the tree. Now, this one on the left is actually in Cookeville, Tennessee. And I haven't seen this myself. If anybody knows where this fossil is and how to see it, I'd like to know, because I wanted to see it myself. But it's an excellent example. And the scientists can discern quite a bit more information about this this fossil from the layers around it. If you notice, my cursor showing up? Okay. Notice that these layers go up in a curve like that. Starts down low here and then goes up here. Starts low here and goes up here. And you can see they're all kind of like that. And this is a very common phenomenon of flowing water around a stationary object. As the water was flowing from right to left in this picture, it would pick up sediment in front of the tree, and then as it slowed down on the other side of the tree, it'd drop it back down. So that's why the level is higher on the left than it is on the right. And scientists can determine quite a bit from that change in the level of the layers. Yellowstone National Park is famous for its for Specimen Ridge, where there are petrified trees in the upright standing position. And so these are good examples of polystrate fossils. here's one I learned about more recently. Up in coal mines, there's a situation called kettle bottoms. Anybody know about kettle bottoms? You do? Oh, maybe I can talk to you about that. Kettle bottoms, as I understand it, are polystrate fossils, trees that span through the coal. And you can see at the top left, there's the stump on the floor of the coal mine. And then below it is the kettle bottom in the roof of the coal mine, of the tunnel. And you can see that this one has some huge bolts. They said they're 8-foot long bolts through these kettle bottoms to hold them up there, because they're very dangerous. A lot of people have been killed by falling kettle bottoms because they're not as well attached to the coal around them. They're polystrate. And so it's an important issue. And back to Cookeville, Tennessee, here's a polystrate fossil, and it looks like it's extended down into coal at the very bottom. So even the evidence from coal mines is good evidence for rapid deposition of sediment, like you would find in the Great Flood. And then fossil graveyards. This is a term used for a place where there are many fossils located in a single place. And there's hundreds of these graveyards all around the world. In Dinosaur National Monument, out in Utah, is a very famous collection of fossils just scrambled up in these layers. And it's a very interesting place to visit. There is, in the Grand Canyon, the red wall limestone of the Grand Canyon, there are literally, this is no exaggeration, there are literally billions of nautiloid fossils. Dr. Stephen Austin has studied these and has shown that in these layers there are nautiloid fossils. These are the ice cream cone shaped fossils, like down here below these black ones here. These are nautiloid fossils from Morocco. Evidently, Morocco is a great place for fossil exploration. There's a lot of fossils coming out of Morocco, and some really beautiful ones. These can be quite large. I've seen a bathtub made out of a single slab of this nautiloid fossil stone. The Green River Formation of Wyoming is famous for its fish, and then also in Colorado is a great fossil location.
Kind of like the Great Fossil Site.
And the Great Fossil Site? Yeah, I don't have anything in here about that. Sometimes I wonder if that's really properly named, because when I've talked to them, they say they're not turned to stone. They're really bones that are buried there. And that deserves some more attention. Like, probably, loosely speaking, they are fossils, but they're not the kind of fossils I'm talking about today. but that'd be an example of a fossil graveyard. You know, a lot of buried animals together in one location. Okay, let me ask you this question. What could cause billions of dead things to be buried in rock layers all over the earth? Okay, this is the background picture here is a great one. I took down in Texas in the museum of all those starfish. That's just a close-up of it. The slab of starfish, it must have been 6 feet tall, covered with these little starfish. But I think the question is a good one. And Ken Ham has become famous for addressing this question and answering it. And again, he says, if there was a worldwide flood described in Genesis, what should we find? Okay, what would he expect to find if such a flood described in the Bible did occur? He says, we should find billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. Okay, well, what do we find? Billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. We find exactly what you'd expect to find if there was a worldwide cataclysm known as the flood. Now, you've probably seen geologic time scales. We had these different periods. Dinosaurs, they say, lived during the Cretaceous, Jurassic, and Triassic periods. And then going older in time, which should be down in the geologic column, down to the Cambrian and the Precambrian, where the oldest fossils are, the simplest ones could be found. And while it's true there's a great deal of sorting between fossils as you go through different layers, nowhere in the world will you find this geologic column lined up just like that. You'll find little bits and pieces, and the geologists have kind of pieced them together trying to put it into one smooth continuum of time. And while those terms are handy to use, really I think this is better described as just flood sediment for many of those periods, and that the order of fossils is a sorting event of the marine animals being buried first, and then leading on to land animals and perhaps the more intelligent and mobile animals like birds and some mammals and humans may have been buried much later. Okay. Congratulations, you've all made it to Final Jeopardy. You are all a contestant in Final Jeopardy. So I'm going to give you the answer, and then whoever can give me the question will be the grand winner. The answer is the study of fossils.
Paleontology.
I'm sorry, you need to put that in the form of a question. You're right. What is paleontology? And I'm glad you asked me that. Okay, I'm going to give you a little better definition now, a little more thorough definition. It's the study of the forms of life existing in prehistoric or geologic times as represented by the fossils of plants, animals, and other organisms. Okay, this gentleman is Pierre-Paul Gresset. He was the most famous French evolutionist, zoologist of the last century, and he very famous evolutionist. And he wrote in a book this quote, which I'm sure evolutionists would all still agree with. The quote is, "Naturalists must remember that the process of evolution is revealed only through fossil forms. A knowledge of paleontology is therefore a prerequisite. Only paleontology can provide them with the evidence of evolution and reveal its course or mechanisms." Okay, so if the evidence is in paleontology for evolution, let's look at paleontology. Let's see if the evidence is there. Let's see if it's true that evolution is true, because we're going to find the evidence in paleontology. That's the importance of knowing something about fossils. And you don't have to be an expert in fossils to have some good arguments to refute many folks' objections to creation. Okay, I want to back up even a little further now. I want to look at the models for the origin of life in the universe. And really, if you think about it, there's only two options for the origin of life in the universe. Either it was created or it was not. There's really no third option, right? Okay. Actually, aliens have been brought up, but we won't go there today. When were they created? Okay, yeah. Okay, so let's compare. These are very basic definitions. Okay, so if the origin of the life in the universe is created, then We're talking about supernatural creation. Okay, there's a creator. Everything is the result of intelligent design, of an intelligent designer creator over a short period of time. The universe and life show signs of intelligent design. And in the beginning, there's a creation event. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about biblical creationism here. I'm a biblical, younger, six-day creationist. This is kind of the bare bones of a creation model versus a non-creation model. Okay, under the non-creation model, we have evolution is the theory, the way things are explained. And we have naturalism. That is, everything is a result of random chance acting over long periods of time upon matter and energy. Obviously, there's no supernatural on this side. And that life may appear designed, but is a result of natural selection. Okay. You can explain everything by natural selection. If it looks like it has design to it, you know, that's just an artifact. Looks like Richard Dawkins will say that to you. And so, in the beginning, in this model, is the Big Bang. Although that theory is very controversial among cosmologists, and they don't have the unified front that the press thinks they have. Okay, now I want to go into a few technical terms. Bear with me as we go through these terms of evolution. They may look complicated, but really they're very simple and easy to understand. The first one of the general evolution model is naturalism. Okay, the universe and all it contains arose by random natural processes. Obviously, no supernatural, no creator. Natural processes, the laws of nature, science, are the only things in effect to cause any kind of change in this model. Okay, the second term is uniformitarianism. And this is a long word, but it's not that hard to understand. It's the geological processes operating now are sufficient to explain past geological events. And the phrase that often used here is the present is the key to the past. And so the amount of silt washing down in rivers into the ocean, that can be measured now. And you can apply those measurements to what must have been in the past and maybe calculate the age of a mountain or a continent or something like that. That's using the principle of uniformitarianism. Okay. Abiogenesis. Okay. A is the negating word for bio, meaning life. Genesis, meaning the beginning. So life began from non-living chemicals. Life began from non-life. Is what this term means. Okay, the next point in the evolution model is phyletic gradualism. Okay, and this means that complex life forms on the planet evolved from simple life forms in numerous small steps over vast periods of time. Many very small steps. You know, a reptile did not give birth to a bird. It had those steps of evolution had to occur over hundreds or thousands of small steps as that leg gradually turned into something closer and closer to being a wing. That's phyletic gradualism. Okay, natural selection is the next point. And this is the creatures, the plants, I suppose, too, that are more fit for its environment to compete with others are the ones that survive. Survival of the fittest, we've heard. And creationists believe this. We observe this in the world around us. In fact, man practices something we call artificial selection. We raise cattle to have certain characteristics. We grow flowers, and I know they made a big fuss about white marigolds a few years ago. It took a lot of artificial selection to make yellow marigolds into white ones. So that's natural selection is something we observe and creationists accept it. And the last point here is The modern evolutionary theory is often called neo-Darwinism, and it includes the genetic mutation mechanism. When Darwin was alive, genetics was not understood. DNA was not understood. He didn't really know how the process occurred. And modern evolutionary theory includes genetics. I put in red here the two points that are critical for the rest of my talk, especially phyletic gradualism, that life evolved in numerous small steps over long periods of time, okay, and then natural selection as well. Now, this is just a cartoon of a serious topic, the evolutionary tree of life, and this is, you know, greatly simplified pictures to show that some single-celled, simple organisms initially, magnified down here, grew and evolved into invertebrate creatures, formed plants and fungi, reptiles and mammals. And that you can link all these together, and they make it into a tree, kind of like a family tree, to connect the different species with one another, different families together. And so this is commonly talked about as the evolutionary tree of life. Darwin used the term descent from a common ancestor. Now, if you look at this tree, though, you notice, what do we see about all the living things that are on this slide? Well, they're all real plants, animals, or insects. Now, some of them may be extinct, like there's a T-Rex here. Those are extinct. But everything shown here is or was once alive. And it's the in-between parts of this tree that are not illustrated. And that's where we have the transition forms. So the individual small steps between one family and another, and one creature and another, they're kind of represented by the line between the different species. And then if I have time, I want to talk about the Cambrian explosion, which is right down here at the bottom, when a huge number of body forms, of life forms, different types, families, and kingdoms, really, formed very suddenly. Okay. So just to make sure we understand what a transition form here is, there's a little cartoon that shows an ox cart going to a stagecoach going to a car. The transition form is obviously, in this little example, the stagecoach. Okay, is in the progress of transportation, that could be called a transition form. And here's a sequence of creatures from some land-dwelling mammal. Some say it may have been a wolf that evolved into whales. And these intermediate forms shown here are the artist's conception of what those intermediate transition forms must have looked like. And you can have a lot of fun with this because there's a lot of ridiculous forms that you might imagine going from a wolf to a whale. And but you'll see these intermediate links, and the artist has to come up with what they might look like. And you've all seen the sequence of evolution of man. There's the intermediate transition forms for that sequence. Okay, so let's look at what the two models. We have a creation model and an evolution model. What do those two models predict we should find in the fossil record? Well, if evolution is true, we ought to find simple life forms appearing initially in the lower layers. And we should see a gradual a change into more complex forms as you go up in the geologic column. You ought to find vast numbers of transition forms. No, there should be no missing links. If there's a missing link, it's because it just hasn't been found yet, or it never formed a fossil, perhaps. Now, in the creation model, we would expect to see in the fossil record complex life forms appearing suddenly in great variety in the layers. And there should be huge gaps between the major kinds because God created them after their own kind. He didn't create intermediate forms between different kinds. And so there should be no transition forms in the creation model. And in the creation model, we would expect many missing links. Okay, well, really, that's the wrong term for us to use because they're not missing. If I told you all that I dropped a $10 bill in this room, would you help me find it? I assume most of you would start, looking around and helping me try to find it. If I said, hey, I left $1 billion somewhere in this room, will you help me find it? Well, you'd think I'm crazy, okay? Okay, it's not because the $1 billion is missing. I never had it. It never existed, okay? So there's a difference between missing and non-existent. And I say that those transition forms are non-existent. Okay, now who knew this better than anybody, which was Charles Darwin. And here's a quote from him. He said, the number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on the earth must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. Written in 1859 in The Origin of Species, this famous book. Well, Darwin was honest enough to say things like this, and he goes into a lot of detail in his book about these problems that he observes. But he felt like paleontology was a young science that with time, eventually more study would turn up these intermediate forms that his theory says must exist. And so I think that was an honest way to look at the situation. But it's been almost 160 years since Darwin published that book, and the situation has not changed. There are still very few, and they're very doubtful and highly disputed fossils that could be a missing link, claimed as a missing link. Now, to be a paleontologist, you want to find a missing link and that fits into evolution. And you don't have to read what this says. It's just one example. They're out every week. You do a Google search on missing link or fossil. Almost every day there's some discovery or some announcement of someone finding this great fossil and how it fills in a missing gap. This one filled in a missing link 400 million years old. And the popular press has fun with this, too. I love this next one. Half alligator, half human found in Florida swamp. Scientists call 5'8" creature the missing link. It even has a picture of the scientists that captured this thing alive. This is one of those rags, these magazines you get at the checkout stand at the grocery store. My wife told me about this, that she saw this at the grocery store. I said, oh, you got to buy it for me. I need to get a copy of this. And she was so embarrassed by it. Oh, she went into great detail with the checkout person. Oh, my husband needs this for you. So anyway, I think this one's hilarious. Okay, I need to move along. This next part is the evolution of flight in the fossil record. I chose this picture. It shows a picture of Icarus. Remember the story of Icarus, the myth, Greek myth of Icarus? His father, Daedalus, had formed wings out of feathers and wax. They attached them to the wings to fly off of Crete to get back to the mainland. And he told his son, Icarus, don't fly so close to the sun. The wax will melt and you'll fall. They'll get close to the water, you'll get wet and you'll fall. Well, Icarus, being a teenager, I guess, we took it close to the sun, melted, and fell to his death in the sea. Okay, a Greek myth. Pastor, you didn't think I'd be preaching and teaching about Greek mythology today, did you? Okay. Now, why did I use this picture? I think it's a beautiful drawing to begin with. But my point is that you don't just strap on some wings, even if they were better built than feathers and wax, put them on your wings and fly away, right? I mean, the flight takes very specialized anatomy. And to evolve from a ground-dwelling creature to a flying creature would have taken incredible changes evolutionary-wise. Just think about all the physiology that has to change. The lung system of birds is amazing. The weight of the bird, hollow bones, so on and so on. There are so many anatomical changes that would have to occur to evolve from a land dweller to a flying creature. That if evolution is true, this is a good place to look for evidence of it. The creatures that evolved to fly, there ought to be great evolutionary evidence for that transition. So we're going to look at the evolution of flight, and we're going to look at how many times it happened first. Okay, I want to introduce you to a word, if you haven't heard this word, volant. Volant means you can fly. An ostrich is a non-volant bird. What's an example of a volant bird? Anybody?
Hawk.
Okay, I chose an eagle. Okay, it's volant, it can fly. What's an example of a non-volant insect? Anybody?
Cockroach.
Some of them can fly. I don't know.
Yeah.
I chose an ant. This is one without wings, so it's non-volant. What's an example of a volant insect? Moth. Okay, I chose this beautiful butterfly. Okay, what's an example of a volant mammal? I mean a non-volant, non-flying mammal. Yeah, there's a lot of examples there. I chose a gerbil because I had gerbils when I was a kid. Now, what's an example of a volant mammal?
Bat.
Okay, I chose the flying monkey. Okay. What's wrong? I got this off the internet. It must be true. And I saw a movie. It had hundreds of these things flying. These flying monkeys flying through the air. Okay. Well, you don't fall for that. Yeah, the bat is the only flying mammal. And they're amazing creatures. I'll talk about them in a minute. Okay. Well, I meant to ask you about flying amphibians. Here is a flying frog. Okay, if you Google flying frog, this is one of the things you'll find, right? Okay. Now, but you'll also find, that's a pretend creature, obviously, you'll find this. This is a real frog. Okay, it's called a flying frog. You've heard of flying squirrels. Do flying squirrels fly? No, they glide. A flying frog has these huge feet with webs, and he can jump out of the tree and actually get a little bit of a glide by stretching out his feet. Amazing creature. God is so incredible in his design. Okay, what about a non-volant reptile? Anybody?
Snake.
Yeah, a snake. Okay. I chose an iguanodon. Actually, there are flying snakes. Again, if you do a YouTube search of flying snakes, you want to be freaked out by snakes that can flatten their ribs and glide through the air dozens of feet by jumping out of a tree. You know, they're in Southeast Asia or someplace, but they're called flying. They glide also. But, you know, people around here would really go crazy if they were flying snakes. Okay, what's an example of a volant reptile? Good. Yeah, an extinct one. Excellent. Okay. Pterodactyl. The pteranodons are flying reptiles. Okay. So, according to evolutionary theory, flight has evolved four times in birds, insects, mammals, and reptiles. Let's have a look at some of these. This is a fossil of Quetzalcoatlus. It's a specimen hanging in the main lobby, the main hall at the Texas Memorial Museum in Austin. I had the opportunity to see this recently. But this Quetzalcoatlus has a wingspan of 40 feet. It's called the Texas Pteranodon. And obviously in Texas, you know, everything's big in Texas. This is said to be the largest flying creature that ever lived. A wingspan of 40 feet. You know, an F-35 has a wingspan of less than that. But I was really interested to look at what they had to say about it. And I know you can't read this. This is the little placard there next to the fossil. And, okay, we're going to focus in on this one paragraph. It says, when pterosaurs are first seen in the fossil record, their flight apparatus is well formed. Truly intermediate stages in evolution from their bipedal archosaur are not known at present. Okay, so they're admitting that there are no known intermediate forms for flying reptiles. The pterodactyl, no known intermediate forms for the pterodactyl. Now, I get a kick out of these names these scientists come up with. They're always out of Greek, and this one means wing finger, pterodactyl, wing finger. And if you look at the fossil, one of its fingers, or toes, if you would rather, goes from here all the way down here. There it is, from there to there. And that forms the front edge of the wing with the membrane. Just an amazing creature. But it could fly. Here's another one called Rhamphorhynchus, and it's a long-tailed pterosaur of the Jurassic period. Its name means break jaw. It had teeth in its jaw. But look at that one finger. Look how long it is. It's longer than its whole body. Almost extends down to the end of the tail. It's gigantic. Now, if there were evidence in the fossil record for the evolution of Rhamphorhynchus, you would expect to see some intermediate forms with that finger that's half as long, or three quarters as long, or a quarter as long. And you don't find them. You find this fully capable of flight creature immediately in the fossil record. But if you think about this intermediate forms, how viable would they be? Natural selection would destroy them. They would be unable to compete, to fly, to climb, to find food. They ought to just die out to other predators. So let's move on to bats. This is Chioptera, meaning hand finger. And if you look at the wing, you can see that its toes, its fingers are extended to form most of the wing. This is a modern bat. You can see the long fingers and how extended they are. And I love this picture here. It's it's the cover of Science Journal, December of 1966. And it's of Icaronychus. Notice the Icarus name in the name. Icaronychus. It is said to be a fossil skeleton of an early Eocene bat, the oldest known flying mammal. Was found in southwest Wyoming. The neat thing about this picture is that here's the fossil. It's the bat all scrunched up like it was hanging from a tree or something. Those are the fossil bones there, and they've superimposed with a double exposure or some photographic method a modern bat with its wings stretched out, and they did that to show the remarkable similarity of the oldest known bat with modern bats. Isn't that great? Now, here's a diagram of Icaronychus at the top, an ink drawing, and the kind of creature that it must have evolved from, some sort of shrew. Now, just imagine for a minute what the intermediate forms must have looked like. These fingers had to have been call them halfway hairy, the one just halfway between the shrew and the bat. His front arms are only half as long as they are in the bat, and his fingers aren't as long either. And so he can't fly yet, but with these huge arms and long fingers, he would be just a monster. He'd be unable to compete, to run, to climb, to fend for himself, to compete with predators. And so natural selection would have killed him off. There's no reason that the intermediate forms between a shrew and a bat should be more able to live and pass on its genes to its progeny. So if you just imagine what had to have existed between these forms, they're illogical. Doesn't make sense with the theory of evolution. And so the oldest known fossil bats look almost identical to modern bats, you know, including things like echolocation. Here's a quote by a paleontologist, evolutionist. He said, "For use in understanding the evolution of vertebrate flight, the early record of pterosaurs and bats is disappointing. Their most primitive representatives are fully transformed as capable flyers." And this is a great quote by Stephen Jay Gould. He was probably the leading evolutionist of our time. He died about 10 years ago. But he was pretty honest about what one finds in the fossil record. He said, "The absence of fossil evidence of intermediary stages between major transitions in organic design, indeed, our inability, even in our imaginations, to construct functional intermediates, in many cases, has been a persistent and nagging problem for gradualistic accounts of evolution." He says, we can't even imagine, like I did with the bat. You can't even imagine what they must have looked like if they were to survive through natural selection. Insects, same story. We'll go into that. These are old fossils of insects, and you could identify most of them, even though they're said to be hundreds of millions of years old. We got dragonflies and everything that we're used to. Okay, let's look at birds. Birds obviously are the pinnacle of things that can fly, and so I want to talk about birds for a minute. And this is where Archaeopteryx comes into play. You can see I don't talk that much, so this is new for me. Okay, Archaeopteryx is one of the most famous fossils that have ever been discovered, said to be an extinct crow-eyed bird, said to have lived 130 to 150 million years ago during the late Jurassic period. This is an amazing fossil. It was found in Bavaria, Germany, more than one specimen. The Berlin specimen shown here is the better one. There's also one in London. But just look at this fossil. It's beautiful. You see the feathers. The impressions of the feathers are there. This is interesting. It has claws on its wing. That's odd. And if you could look close, you'd see that it has teeth. This is a bird that has teeth in its mouth. It has a long, bony tail with beautiful feathers. Just a remarkable specimen. And the experts can even look at the body cavity and determine more about its internal organs and its skull. In the British Museum, I saw this display, and they said, "Archaeopteryx, the first bird." And this paragraph here says, "Archaeopteryx is particularly famous as it seems to provide a missing link between modern birds and dinosaurs. While it has the impressions of feathers, a feature unique of birds, it also has many reptilian characteristics such as teeth, clawed fingers, and a long bony tail." Okay, so is Archaeopteryx a transition form between reptiles and birds? That's the question. Well, it did have these reptile-like features. It had teeth. And modern birds don't have teeth. Long bony tail, you could say that's a vestige of its reptile ancestry. I had a shallow breastbone, so it must not have been a very good flyer. And had claws on its wings. Well, that's kind of strange. And, you know, possibly it's showing a transitional development from of the wing from legs. So there you have it. My whole talk has just been ruined by this one fossil. We might as well go home and hang it up. Okay, but wait, not so fast. Let's consider these points about Archaeopteryx. There are fish, amphibians, reptiles, and mammals with and without teeth. Some other fossil birds had teeth. And the teeth differed distinctly from those of reptiles. So whether or not it had teeth or not really doesn't matter. If this crowd were older, I might say some of you have teeth and some don't. Okay, the tail is said to be very similar to a swan's tail. And it had a furcula, that's the wishbone, for attachment of flight muscles. It clearly was a flying creature, a flying bird. And some modern birds have claws in their wings. Okay, so that's not so odd after all. The ostrich, the Watson, and the Turaco. Now, the last two, the claws are while they're juveniles, and they fall off after they mature. Also, archaeologists had a bird-like skull with movable upper and lower jaws. Reptiles have just a lower movable jaw. The archaeologists could move both. And importantly, archaeologists had modern feathers. Okay. Now, the most famous, the best well-known, most respected evolutionist ornithologist is Professor Alan Fiducia at UNC. He said, "I conclude that Archaeopteryx was arboreal, lived in trees, and volant, considerably advanced aerodynamically, and probably capable of flapping powered flight to at least some degree. Archaeopteryx probably cannot tell us much about the early origin of feathers and flight in true protobirds because Archaeopteryx was, in the modern sense, a bird." He very adamantly comes out against the dinosaur to bird evolutionary thought. So my conclusions on Archaeopteryx is that it is not an example of a transition form and does not provide support for the theory of evolution. It's better viewed as just a unique extinct bird species. There's a lot of extinct species out there. Also, Archaeopteryx, interestingly, is alleged to be 153 million years old. Okay, so it's out of order because there are its dinosaur ancestor, so they say, the Sinosauropteris, is dated at 125 million years ago, and we all know that grandsons are not older than their grandfathers. So Archaeopteryx does not fit in with the proper evolutionary time sequence. And I want to talk about feathers a minute, but when I pulled this picture up, I've been using it for years, I thought, boy, this bird looks like he has Donald Trump's hairstyle. This is a golden pheasant native to Western China. Okay, sorry. Just a word about feathers. Feathers are unique to birds. There are no other creatures that have feathers beside birds. And they're very intricate units of creation. And I won't go into it a lot for time reasons, but feathers are amazing. But evolutionists say, well, feathers probably evolved from reptile scales. You can imagine, this is a snake skin. The surface of a snake, and those scales, just imagine over many, many millions of years, those scales getting longer and longer and longer until finally they've evolved into a feather. Well, that's ridiculous because snakes, this is a snake skin, a shed snake skin. The scales of a snake skin are folds in the skin, just like if you had a piece of fabric and you folded it on itself. That's what the scales are of a snake. And furthermore, feathers, like hairs, come out of a follicle. And there's no follicles in a snake skin. So the whole idea of feathers evolving from scales is ridiculous. Okay. I have a section here on the Cambrian explosion, but I probably should skip this for time reasons and move on to the end. let me give you this quote, again by Stephen Jay Gould, highly respected. He was the patriarch of evolution until he died. He said, "The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils." And that's definitely the case. Living fossils is a subject that we could go into, but I'll skip that today. Okay, let's get to our conclusions. I say that the fossil record reveals the sudden appearance of the higher categories of plants and animals with no evidence of transitional forms. and therefore contradicts the major prediction of evolutionary theory. So those transition forms are a requirement of evolutionary theory. The fossil record is consistent with creatures reproducing after their kind, as we read in Genesis 1, and is consistent with a worldwide marine cataclysm that annihilated the continents and all flesh in which is the breath of life. And we read about the flood in Genesis 6 to 9. Now, I call fossils evangelistic rocks, okay, because they have a message to give. And sometimes when I give this talk, I hand out a little trilobite to everybody, and hoping they'll remember some of this. Because fossils give evidence of God's judgment on sin. Let's read some of Genesis 6 here. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered, and all flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind. Of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life died. But we saw God's justice there. We also see a promise in his mercy and a gift. In Genesis 9, 14 to 15, we read, "And it shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow, the rainbow, shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh." So, just as Noah trusted God for salvation from the flood, so too we must repent and trust God for salvation from the penalty of our sins through faith in his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. I could recommend other books to read if you're interested. These are a couple of really good ones that I've benefited from. And there are a lot more new ones out there as well. In fact, this Michael Denton, Evolution of Theory in Crisis, has been recently updated, and I need to get the new copy. When he wrote this book, he was not a creationist. He was an evolutionist, fairly evaluating evolution. And I think he's come over at least halfway to an intelligent design position.
Transition form? Is he a transition form?
He's a transitioning. Yeah, he's evolving. That's a good way to use that word. So, anyway, although it's not written by a Christian, it's a great book with a lot of information. So, with that, I'll close it up. Are there any questions? I know I've gone quite long. Yeah.
I've never heard that the Stephen Jay Gould quote, not the last one, but the one before that, where he says that we can't come up with, even in our imaginations, functional transitions between animals. And like that was incredible, because he was and then he died an evolutionist still.
Yeah.
Don't you think this? A couple things. Don't you think that shows that he really has absolutely no connection at all to observable evidence or science? He's really just doing a philosophical, religious worldview. And also, would you comment on his theory of punctuated equilibrium, which is kind of his response to that problem?
Right. Yeah, Gould recognized that there's these huge gaps in the fossil record. How do you explain that? And he doesn't want to believe the obvious. He was a Marxist too, I believe, and he would not. He was Romans 1, right? Willingly ignorant. I mean, we all know that the Creator exists, but are willingly suppressing that knowledge. So he came up with a theory called punctuated equilibrium, and very controversial subject. Basically, saying that evolution, when it occurred, it happened real fast. You know, in little jumps. It happened so fast you didn't see it. There's no left behind evidence in the fossil record. And it's ridiculous. Why should evolution take these sudden steps? Some people went so far as to say that indeed a reptile laid an egg, and when it hatched, a bird came out. And that book, I wish I could get a copy of that book. It would be wonderful. I saw it on a videotape described. It was endorsed by the the American Association of Science, the leading science organization in the United States. Amazing, amazing that they would do that because it's so ridiculous. He had to fall back on this theory that's you don't hear it talked about much anymore because it's just so insane that the evolution should happen so fast in little spurts. Although I did read about it recently concerning the Cambrian explosion that we didn't get into, because in the Cambrian explosion you see all these creatures all of a sudden in the lower layers, all these different body forms are there with no ancestry below them. And how'd that happen? We say they were created, and then the flood laid those down first. And some people seem to be falling back on, well, evolution happened so fast before the Cambrian period that we just don't see any of the fossils. Or they were soft bodied, so they didn't form fossils. That's why that slide on soft bodied fossils is important. They do form fossils. And when you look at the Precambrian sediments under the microscope, there's all these microscopic sponges and embryos that are soft-bodied, and they're there by the by the millions. They didn't destroy. They weren't destroyed over time. Okay, I know it went fast, but that's my fossils talk. It's a great subject. Let me just show you one more picture. I don't see anybody jumping out of their seat yet. And this is a dinosaur. This is such an important subject. Dinosaur soft tissue. It wasn't long ago that it was discovered in a T-Rex bone that there was soft tissue still inside. In fact, these bones from the Hell's Creek formation west of eastern Montana, they always had a bad smell. And it was just well known that these fossils stunk. And, why should old fossils, that are 150 million years old, still smell, of decay? Like, they smell like corpses. And this scientist, Mary Schweitzer, had to break into a T-Rex bone. It was too big to move, and they had to cut it in half in order to transport it. When they cut it in half, they saw this soft material in the middle. They looked at it under the microscope, and there's elastic tissue, soft tissue, fibrous tissue. They look at it in the microscope and they see red blood cells and blood vessels. These are materials that should not survive millions of years. These are organic materials that should rapidly decompose under any conditions, very rapidly. Yet they say that this fossil is 65. Million years old, yet it has soft tissues. You can even identify red blood cells in there. And here's what she said. I'm quite aware that according to conventional wisdom and models of fossilization, these structures aren't supposed to be there, but they are. And I was pretty shocked. And they were very cautious to get this information out. But since she has, there's been a flood of other people discovering soft tissue in fossils. And It's a strong evidence against evolution, against long ages, I should say.
2,000 years would shock me. I mean, to have it. I don't understand that.
Yeah, yeah. But T-Rex, 65 million years normally? It's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. Okay. There's so much good stuff in the study of fossils. I could go on, you can tell, a lot longer, but my voice will give out. But I think just to kind of sum it up, there is so much easily understood evidence, basic information that any of us can use without a lot of study to refute or challenge folks to consider their worldview, consider their blind acceptance of evolution. And, there should be a better explanation for what we see in the world around us. And hopefully that can lead you into being a witness for the gospel. And that's the whole purpose, to study, you know, these dirty old rocks, is to be a witness to others. Pastor?
Heavenly Father, we are thankful for Stephen for his presentation to us this morning, and pray that you would help us to retain and remember. And it's really, really helpful information that really pokes major holes in what is the dominant perspective of our time, and that is resolutely opposed to you existing and being our creator and being our judge. We pray that you would help us remember these things, to take them into the marketplace of ideas, that we might be more faithful as ambassadors for Christ to those who are around us that don't know.